wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truthtoyou.org. That's truth2u.org. I'm Jono. Joining me from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net. G'day, my friend.
Jason of Spiritual Babies. Makes him sound like a knight. I like it.
Okay. Sir Jason of Spiritual Babies, and currently just across from my island, on his island in Jakarta, Indonesia, is the author of the recently released Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, Volume 1 and 2, a brilliant couple of books that I insist all listeners get hold of, vital reading for listeners of Truth to You. You can get a copy of from his website, outreachjudaism.org, outreachjudaism.org. Welcome back to the program, Rabbi Tovia Singer.
Hey, great to be on. I was just thinking as you did that intro, Jono, that wouldn't it be funny if Jason, I mean, we don't really know where he is, do we? I mean, it's not like,
all I know is that he's near the Guinness factory in Ireland somewhere. I know that much.
But, you know, he could be in Brooklyn for all we know, and he's just doing the accent. You know, like, no one really knows where he is.
Yeah, we're going to cut this bit out because you're getting too close to the truth.
We don't really know. I mean, he could be on McDonald Avenue for all we know. He could be the chief rabbi of Brooklyn. We have no idea.
Seen them both in the same room.
Yeah, it could be he's across the hall from me and I had no idea this whole thing. He's just been avoiding me this whole thing. He's from Ireland. Ireland. He says he's from Ireland because he knows that we'll never go there to check it out.
No, we won't.
That's true. That's as far as you can go.
Who's from Ireland? What's Ireland? Irish, Ireland.
Listen, Ireland's boy. You're in.
In fact, I'm looking through my window in Jakarta, and I'm looking at another guy sitting at a desk in his house, and he's looking at a computer, and he's blushing red like that, and he has a Jack Daniels next to him, but that's all we know. He's a very handsome fellow, and it could very well be that's Jason right there.
I'm waving just on the off chance.
Oh my gosh. So we don't really know. We say Ireland. We can't be sure of this, but it's, you know, it's a,
we can't be sure. If anyone's ever met Jason Spiritual Babies in real life, let us know, just to confirm that he is who he says he is, because I've never really thought about that before. You could be onto something. Now listen, I just want to mention to the listeners just the dedication of Tovia Singer to be on Truth to You. He was somewhere in Indonesia, who knows where, in the jungle somewhere, and there was no reception, so he got into a cab at peak hour traffic in Indonesia, Jakarta. I have no idea what that could possibly be like. Traveled for over an hour to get to a place where there was better internet connection, and here he is. But I want to know, Tovia.
Yes.
Peak hour in Jakarta as opposed to peak hour in New York.
No, you can't compare the two. You can't compare the two. In New York, there are highways. Besides the local roads, you know, there are highways that you know, there's the FDR Drive, there are all sorts of highways, the Belt Parkway, and so on. Don't compare, I'm sure, not that I've been on whatever, the Bond, whatever those Germans have, whatever that fast moving.
The Autobahn, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it is where those Nazis are flying around. But we don't, but in New York there are highways. There are highways aside, but Jakarta is a city of some 12 million people, and there really are not really highways to speak of. I think about two-thirds of the motorists are riding on an amalgam of a hybrid of a motorcycle and a bicycle. So there's some sort of scooter.
This is those little, they're like little scooters with umbrellas, right? Mm. What are those things called?
The scooters with umbrella. I have no idea.
That's it.
Whole families ride on these together. I mean, like four people on one of them together. They're moving furniture on these things. I don't know how they do it. They carry little babies on them. I mean, they're very, like in the United States, I don't know how it is in Australia, but the United States, like riding a motorcycle is like something someone, I don't know, like sort of, I don't know, cool, but it's like kind of a, but here it is in Jakarta, it is like, that's how people move around. And they're going to have three, four people on there. So the cars really have to avoid hitting these things. And it's, wow. It's rough getting around. This is not a highly developed city, but it is an enormous population, huge. And the roads are not, well, they're not well maintained. You could sense the fact that in Indonesia, the money that comes into the country does not trickle down to the people in the way that it should ordinarily.
The way that
do.
It should.
Yeah, wow. You know,
so the infrastructure's not there like it is in New York. What about Israel? Come on, what about Israel in peak hour?
You can't compare. If you're comparing the two, so there are parts of Jakarta during peak hour, which are a parking lot where you might as well get out and walk. And it's really
the thing that I notice about in Israel. I don't know if the same in Indonesia or New York, but in Israel, everyone seems to beep their horn, even if there's nothing to beep.
This is something I have to warn people about. In Israel, when you beep your horn, that's the equivalent of saying Merry Christmas. I'm just wanting people to know that. That's like in the United States, if you beep a horn, and especially in the United States where guns are legal, where ordinary citizens are allowed to have guns, if you beep your horn, you don't have like a pretty good reason. So, you know, that's like a very serious assault. Like you're saying something about a fellow's mother when you beep a horn, but in Israel that's like good morning, like how are you, like you know, happy Easter. It's in Israel it's like normal, like you beep a horn. They're in Israel, they're in a rush. In fact, I don't know how it is in Australia, but in Israel, in the United States, so when the light goes from green to red, there's a yellow light that precedes the red light, which in Israel has that as well, which warns motorists that, look, a red light's coming up really soon, so if you're not right at the intersection, it's a good idea to slow down. Israel has this very unusual thing, which I haven't really noticed anywhere else. I'm not the biggest world traveling world, but I've gotten around. Israel actually has a yellow light before the green light as well, which tells the motorists that the green light is about to come, which means rev your engines, get rolling. That I find very, very striking. So, I mean, what is that about? Like, who came up with that thought? Like, we need information to build the car.
No, we have that. Okay, so here in Australia, we've got the orange light before it goes red, and that makes perfect sense. But when the green light comes, it's like, surprise, it's a green light, you can go now, but there's no like, where it's about to go green. So what you're saying is when you're in Israel, when it goes from red to orange, everyone just takes off.
Oh, yeah. So then people already are starting to fly. So by the time it actually hits green, people are doing full throttle 120 kilometers an hour because they've already been able to start. You know, it does take, 6 seconds for the average 200 horsepower car to actually go from zero to things. So people are in, I don't know what it is. It is a cultural thing, but people are in a rush. And the honking the horn is not as much of an assault, like I want to destroy your family, as it would be in Dallas, Texas, or that would be understood. You know,
you're taking your life into your own hands. Yeah,
yeah. In the United States, you're honking your horn, you have to have a good reason. In fact, I don't know what's going on in Australia and Ireland. No one cares. it's a serious matter, and there are some areas where it's forbidden to honk your horn for no reason. They actually get a fine for it in the United States. In Israel, if they catch you not honking your horn, they get throw you in prison. I'm kidding. But it is. That's the only thing is the people do. They're a little in a rush. They have to go somewhere. They're just not sure yet.
So some of the differences in peak hour. But we appreciate you. We appreciate you getting all the way from A to B today in peak hour Jakarta, because I know that's an effort, and I'm glad that we have you here today because Jason. Mm. Does the word Trinity appear in the Christian Bible?
No, it doesn't.
Don't think it does. Don't think it appears in the Tanakh. But did you know that that the theology of the Trinity is well and truly established in the very first book of the Torah?
Oh, do tell.
Do tell! Not only that, but it proves that God can appear in a human form. How about that? That's a double whammy for Christianity.
Oh, I wish someone had told me that 2 years ago.
If only someone had told. And so what we have all the way in peak hour traffic rushing to get to Truth to You on time is to clear this up for us, Rabbi Tobias Singer. Here we are in Genesis chapter 18.
Yeah, here we are. And so the listeners are not confused by what they're hearing right now, I think it's important for them, just as an introduction, to understand that the very earliest Christians would never even conceive that their Jesus, who they would come to believe as the Messiah, would be a God. This is a much later development in the church. And for that reason, we don't have what's called this higher Christology, this notion that Jesus is very exalted, certently not until you get to the book of John, which is the last, chronologically, it's the last of the Gospels to be written. But what we find instead in the earliest Gospels, I mean, is what's called an exaltation Christology, or a lower Christology, which means, or an adoptionist Christology. These are all fancy terms that are used, but what the earliest Christians believed was that Jesus was a man, not a God. But as by the year, about the year 50, and by the year 50 is critical, because that's also when the New Testament is being written. Now, those who are writing like letters of Paul, 1 Thessalonians will be chronologically the oldest letter that we have. He may have written something early, we just don't have it. At that time, Jews are not really turning to Christianity anymore, converting to Christianity. From about the year 50, the vast bulk of those who are becoming Christians are Gentiles, are non-Jews. And Paul is going to be addressing them for the most part throughout his letters. Paul's letters are written in the 50s, essentially from about 49 till about 60. Romans would be the last and most important book that Paul is going to write. There are 13 books attributed to him, but of the seven that we know he wrote or came out of the same hand, that would be the last, and that's really the constitution of Christianity. There's going to be a huge development as Christianity creeps to the end of the first century, because as Gentiles are coming in, and the focus turns to them on how they should become Christians, or what exactly are they to believe, Christianity is going to be conveyed in a way that the pagans could understand. And what the pagans understood in the Greco-Roman world, in the ancient world, was that if a person was very great, he was really extraordinary, he couldn't just be human. He must be more than human. He must be like Hercules or Pythagoras. They must have been someone who somehow, they were part man, but also part God. And that's how the development would unfold. And so Pythagoras, who we know him as, of course, a great philosopher, a great writer, a great mathematician, the ancient world, he was thought no one could be that brilliant and be completely human. So he was born of a virgin, incarnated by Zeus, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Hercules. No one could be that great an athlete. And he must have been part God. And of course, the idea would be developed that Hercules, too, would be born of a virgin, born of Zeus and a virgin mother. He actually had a twin who was not born of a virgin, which I never quite figured out.
That's difficult.
Yes, very difficult, but that's how the story goes, that Hercules had a twin brother, and Hercules was conceived of a virgin, but his twin brother was not conceived of a virgin. The way the story goes, Hercules' father went out to war, and his mother was already pregnant. Apparently, the ancient world didn't know a lot about
biology.
Yeah. So as the story goes, Zeus incarnates himself into a man, not any man, but a man who looks just like just like Hercules' father. And he just shows up at the door. The wife greets him. She thinks he's out to war. She's as happy as could be that her husband came home earlier than he thought. And of course, Zeus impregnates her. And then Zeus goes back to his heavenly realm, and now she's impregnated a second time. She's now carrying two babies inside of her. Romulus, the founder of Rome. So this is very important in the ancient world. It sounds a little ridiculous to us, but in the ancient world, and when we talk about the Greco-Roman world, when historians do, we're talking about a period from about 200 BCE to around 200 CE. Mm-hmm. Now, so as the development takes place in Christianity, where Christianity begins as essentially a heterodox. Heterodox is probably another word for heresy. Heterodox means another doxy, which means another opinion. As Christianity begins, it's a strictly monotheistic religion that that points to Jesus and says that Jesus is the Messiah. But he there's nothing unusual about his conception or birth. And that's why, if we look at the first gospel, and I say the first gospel, I mean the earliest gospel, but not as it appears in a Christian Bible, meaning we're looking at the book of Mark. Mark, that's a tradition, that's Christian oral law, that Mark wrote the book of Mark. Okay. According to Christian tradition, Mark is not a disciple. Mark was a essentially a companion over a secretary for Peter, and he would write the book.
I thought he was a companion of Paul. Didn't Paul have an argument with him, and he said, "I don't want to travel with you anymore"? Right. And then Barnabas said, "Well, I'm going to go with Mark." Then and they all had a big upset.
Yeah, they had an upset, and that's very. Very likely that happened in the book of Acts. Paul had trouble with a lot of people. Paul had far more enemies than friends. And that is very likely to be historical, because it's very unlikely that someone would invent the fact that Paul is fighting with the companion of Peter, fighting with Peter himself in the book of Galatians, where he says, "I told Peter to his face." It's very, that's the kind of, it's called, what one scholar calls it, the criteria of embarrassment, which means if something is embarrassing to Christianity, namely that there would be fighting among the most important or earliest Christians, it's unlikely that someone would have invented that. And therefore, it's more likely to be historical than to actually have occurred. It's very unlikely. And therefore, it makes sense why the book of Acts would be written. The book of Acts, or the real name, would be the Acts of the Apostles. We don't, again, know who wrote that. We just know whoever wrote Luke wrote the book of Acts is devoted to one thing. We take the book of Acts. It has one purpose for existing, and that is to show that there's absolute harmony in the church. The purpose of the book of Acts is to express one thing. 26 chapters are devoted to illustrating that, in fact, everybody was on the same page. That Peter and Paul, they all got together and they were all working the same direction. And the disharmony, in fact, was widely misunderstood. The idea that Paul would come in and circumcise Timothy, that's not something that Paul would ever... Could you imagine Paul conceding that he would bring, you know, he'd be circumcising someone, when in Galatians he's saying that if you are circumcised, Christ will avail you nothing. You
won't find... Nothing, yeah.
Right, you will not find any of that. Or that Paul has to consult with the Jerusalem church, and Paul would never concede something that he had to go to Jerusalem to consult with them, because as far as Paul was concerned, he was being accused of being a charlatan, of a Johnny-come-lately, of a person who was inventing a gospel. So Paul will insist, in fact, that everything he received is directly from Jesus Christ. So we have there's very striking differences between the ministry, the traveling of Paul, as we will find it in the book of Acts, then we'll find it in Paul's own writings. The idea even his name was being Saul. Paul never mentions that his name was Saul. That's a claim made strictly by the idea of being a citizen of Rome. That's not something Paul's going to make, but that's going to be a claim that the author of Luke Acts is going to make. So there's a wide disparity between them. But what's very important to us is when we look at the book of Mark, which is much earlier, the book of Mark is probably written about 35 years after the crucifixion or so, probably around the year 65 or 70. The book of Mark, whoever wrote it, thought there was nothing remarkable about Jesus' birthplace, nothing unusual about his conception, about his birth, and therefore we are introduced to Jesus at his baptism. That's how the book of Mark opens. In fact, we're told something very strange as the book of Mark opens. This is the first gospel chronologically. We're told that John the Baptist is baptizing people. And what is the purpose of why John the Baptist is baptizing anyone? He's baptizing people so that their sins would be removed, which is very strange, because that will not be consistent with the later Christian theology. And that is that Jesus had to die for sins, and baptism can't... baptism or your own repentance or anything other than blood being shed for you could atone for your sins. But that's where
Jesus jumps right in there and gets baptized too, which kind of upsets the apple cart.
Right. He gets baptized there, and the voice from heaven, when we discussed this, I think, in a previous show, the voice from heaven says, "You are my son, who I'm well pleased." And again, we have that in the book of Mark, that it's very clear that Jesus becomes God's son at his baptism. That's what's very, very important. This is going to change radically as we move further away from the crucifixion. Later on, further on in the first century, Jesus is going to become the Son of God at the point of his conception. And this is where Matthew and Luke are lined up. There, Matthew and Luke are written again approximately 15 years after the book of Mark. There, it's very clear that that Jesus becomes the Son of God, not at his baptism, but he's going to become Jesus' son at his birth, being born of a virgin. In John, we have what's called higher Christology. And that means that here we have a very elevated view. The most elevated view of Jesus, most exalted view of Jesus, is clearly portrayed in what is without a doubt the most argued over passages in the entire Christian Bible. And that's called the prologue of John. It's John chapter 1, verse 1 through 18. But we're not sure who he's talking about when the Word becomes flesh, but we're really sure who he has in mind by the time we get to verse 17. And there Jesus is now, he became God some in the way past, some before he was conceived, at some distant past. Now, what exactly those passages mean are not clear, but one thing is sure, and that is that John is not interested in Jesus being born of virgins. He's not interested in Jesus' mother. In fact, it's the only gospel in which Jesus' mother is never mentioned by name. And the first time Jesus' mother is mentioned, she's referred to as such in John 4, where Jesus speaks to a woman, "What do I have to do with you?" It's a very strange way to speak to your mom. But what's being conveyed there is that you didn't have anything to do with this. I'm from another place. And that takes place in the first miracle of Jesus. Usually it's for many people. In Ireland, it's for the Irish, it's considered the favorite, Jesus' best, most favored miracle. That's where he turns water into wine.
Like that one.
Yeah, so which doesn't make any sense as far as the Assemblies of God goes and other that are against alcohol, because Jesus should have been turning wine into water. Right, I mean that.
Which would be most unpopular at a party, but yeah. Sure.
So now, what happens? So there's this development and there's this trajectory. Mark ends without a resurrection appearance. Mark ends in Mark 16 verse 8. Women are told by a man, we don't know if it's whatever it is, an angel or a man, but told that Jesus rose. The women say nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Later on, 12 verses will be appended to the end of the book of Mark of resurrection appearances, because scribes obviously later on would find that so problematic that they. But here's the key point. As Christianity moves further and further away from its starting point, Judaism, it not only has to adopt a new idea, new thinking, but a second element has to be introduced, must be introduced, and that is that there's passages. That means, doesn't the Bible teach these ideas? Where is the notion that the Messiah is going to die for anybody's sins? Why doesn't the Bible mention that? Well, the Bible must mention that. There has to be some support for these ideas in the Hebrew Bible, in Tanakh, in the Jewish scriptures. I remember once doing a show. I was on a Christian show, and it's on YouTube. It must have like a million and a half hits. I don't know how many, but I was doing a kind of a debate, I guess, with Nathan Lane Craig, a preeminent Christian apologist. And I challenged him, and I said to him, where is the doctrine of the Trinity in the Hebrew Bible? Where is the idea that there's one God in three persons articulated, expressed in the Jewish Bible? And he said, it isn't there. It isn't there because they couldn't come up with anything in the Jewish Bible for it, even that can even remotely resemble that. Strangely, I think many people are aware of the fact from listening to our shows that the Jewish Bible was altered and manipulated by the church to make it appear Christological. What I think many people do not know is that the New Testament was altered far more than the Jewish Bible was. And in fact, scribes would insert a Trinitarian passage into 1 John 5:7. It's called the Joannian pause. It's essentially a clause that where we have a Trinity, but that everyone can see that was a later insertion. All Christians can see that. Usually it doesn't appear there, and the King James will have it in brackets with a footnote. So what the church has to do, it has to be able to demonstrate that the idea that Jesus is God manifested in the flesh, this was in fact, this notion is in fact ensconced, well inserted in the Hebrew Bible, in the Jewish scriptures. Well, how do you do something like that? After all, could there be a text that opposed the notion that there could be any other God but God of Israel, our Father, having not one God at the end of the book of Malachi, is in the middle of the book of Malachi, is only one. There is no one else besides me. There's no saviors besides me. I am the one. I'm the only one. See, there's no one with me. Read Isaiah chapter, 42, 43, for all the way through 48. Mm-hmm. Isaiah is going to attack this notion that there can be any kind of multiple persons or there are any other God. Lo yilcho Elohim Achim Alpanai. We read that in the Torah portion just now. You shall have no other gods upon my face. So what the church will do is it will look at passages or point to verses in the Hebrew Bible where it is speaking, where the scripture is speaking about a person or an angel that is performing the work of God and is therefore called God in the Jewish scriptures. And this can be very confusing to people. And there are many examples of passages in the Jewish scriptures where when someone is performing the work of God, he is called God in the Bible. Isaiah, in the famous chapter 7, in the passage, in the chapter that Matthew will point to, Isaiah is speaking to Ahaz. Ahaz was the king of Davidic king, the father of Hezekiah. And when Isaiah responded to Ahaz, it says, and God spoke to Ahaz, literally using the name of God. And that's Isaiah chapter 7, verse 10. And in Exodus chapter 7, verse 1, we have Moses, who is called a god. Moses is reluctant. Yes. Yeah. So, but there are other passages where people find very confusing. Now, this is the reason why really good people who mean well could make a very serious mistake here. And I want to explain this point. Is in our vernacular, when we're speaking here today, we're doing this broadcast on Truth to You. So in our modern age, we don't speak this way. That means when as monotheists, as followers of the God of Israel, our vernacular, in our lexicon, there's only one God. Only one being is called God, and that's the creator of the entire universe and the God of history, the God who redeemed Israel out of Egypt, the God who protects the people of Israel today. No one else in our contemporaneous vernacular is spoken of as God. And that's why these passages can be misunderstood easily when, for example, in the Jewish Bible, angels are called God or judges are called God in Deuteronomy chapter 17. People, because we don't talk that way, but Tanakh does, people could assume that, are there in fact people that could be gods? Could angels be called God? Well, the answer is they are in the language of the Bible. What Scripture seeks to convey is that these people are acting on behalf of God. And Shliach Shalodom, which means the person, one who acts as a messenger, is like the one who sent him. But this could be very confusing to folks. And that's why Genesis chapter 18 and 19, those two chapters, very famous. This is the chapters where Abraham has just endured circumcision. He was nearly 100 years old. God had appeared to him in the previous chapter and tells him that he's going to have a son. Abraham is absolutely bewildered. How is it possible at his age, and his wife was not a youngster, how is it possible that this old couple would have a God? And God says, no, it's going to be from your wife. You can have God. Abraham falls on the floor, and he begins Vayitzchak, and he began to not laugh as in jest, but laugh out loud with great joy. Mm-hmm. Now, what's very interesting is in the next chapter, this is one of the most famous encounters in the Bible. Abraham is at the opening of his tent. He encounters three people that he perceives to be travelers, people who are...
It's a little bit more, confusing, but than that, because the very first verse says, "Then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, and he was sitting at the door in the tent door in the heat of the day. And so he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing there." So what we have is God appearing to him and then three men appearing to him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them. He bowed himself down to the ground and said, "My Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant." And so he wants to feed them. He wants to be hospitable to them, and he makes haste to do so. And during this, he gets into a conversation with one in particular, and it says in verse 17, "And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing?" And it seems that God is speaking to him in the first person.
Right. That's correct. Now, of course, there should be a number of questions that are raised here. The first is, there's a transition that's missing from the passage, meaning Tanakh, the Torah, is not concerned with addressing a question, and that is, at some early stage, Abraham thinks that he is helping out strangers. He's recovering from circumcision, and he's coming there to feed them and to take care of them, so he does not know who they really are. We're never told at what stage, at what moment Abraham apprehends that he is not encountering travelers, but he's encountering angels. Now, each angel is given a task. One of those angels, his task is to give Abraham the news that Abraham and his wife Sarah are going to have a son. They're going to have a baby by the next year. His job, that angel's job, is completed at that point. And therefore, he leaves the scene. Genesis 19, which is a continuation, has the other two men who are now finally introduced to us as angels. We're finally told explicitly that the two other angels, because there are two more jobs to do, and that is, one is to rescue Lot and his family, his wife and two daughters, and another angel has to destroy Sodom, this city that is so wicked. He has to destroy it. So at some stage, this is critical, Abraham apprehends that in fact he's dealing with beings that are divine. I don't mean that they're God, but that they're holy. They are from God. They're not just travelers. They're also, what needs to be explained is, why doesn't Sarah have this information? That means Abraham right away gets it that these people, as soon as the angel says you're going to have a child, Abraham gets it. I understand that this is in fact from God, and we're going to have a child. But there's an interesting language, and that is, when Sarah hears this, she laughs, but in a different way. The Hebrew is slightly different. Abraham, at the end of Genesis 17, says Vayitzchak, and that's the name Yitzchak, and Abraham laughed with joy. But Sarah, who was not present in that encounter, she's Vatitzchak, which means laughed at the idea. To her, it was preposterous. The reason is obvious, that Sarah, she's never been given the prophecy from God, as Abraham had in Genesis 17. So to her, a woman of her age, it was impossible and conceivable that she can bear a child. Abraham already has information which Sarah doesn't have, so he is Vayitzchak, and Yitzchak is to be named after not the laughter of Sarah, which people often think about, but really it's the laughter of Abraham in Genesis 17. But Titzchak, it's a different Hebrew word, is not just to laugh, but to laugh at. I mean, Sarah is going to become very uncomfortable with that. Abraham apprehends immediately that he is hearing now the voice, a message that can be trusted, that is from God. And now here's where people could certainly become very, very confused. They can become confused because we see very clearly that God is going to destroy Sodom. He's going to destroy this place. If you look at Genesis, we look at Genesis chapter verse 17, and God said, as you just mentioned, shall I hide from Abraham this thing that I am about to do? I'm going to destroy Sodom. But if we go to the next chapter in Genesis chapter 19, here the two other angels, and now they're identified angels, and the church can't do anything with that. That means they kind of have the Trinity thing and having the three there, but because they can't have two angels, because the Holy Ghost can't be an angel, so that doesn't work. So pretty much the church uniformly understands Genesis 19 verse 1 as we're speaking about angels here. We're not those two who go down to Lot and his family. They're angels of the Lord, and they're identified that way very
clearly. And therefore a Christian apologist will not use this passage as support for the Trinity. Before we move on from that, Jason, have you ever heard a Christian use Genesis 18 as a proof text for Trinitarian theology?
That happens all the time. I mean, it helps the Trinitarians that there are three characters.
Because I've experienced that as well. You have, okay.
Yeah, and it helps also that the text has punctuation on it, which maybe helps the argument. I mean, but I have to be honest, when I read through Genesis 18:1, if I read it as it's written, there's this great thing about Rudyard Kipling. When he put a comma in, it's a breath. And when he put a full stop in, there's two breaths. But so when I read this, and the Lord appeared to him by the terebinths of Mamre, as he sat in the tent and the door of the heat of the day, take stop, and his eyes were down, and his eyes, he lifted his eyes and looked up, and then he saw three men. That for me is two different instances. So I don't connect those two things, but I can see how if you want it to, it's very easy to connect those two things.
Right.
Tobia.
The traditional way, in fact, of reading it requires the knowledge of chapter 17. The chapter breaks that you, the listener, see, are chapter breaks that were created in the medieval period by the Archbishop of Canterbury. But in fact, if you put chapter 17 together and realize what's the context here, Abraham is at the opening of his tent. He's recovering from circumcision. Abraham's essence is to do kindness, perform acts of kindness for people. And it's very, very hot outside. And God, as you said, Jason, visits Abraham because there's this important teaching, and we follow God in this way, to visit the sick. He's visiting Abraham as he's recovering. Suddenly, as God is visiting Abraham, Abraham sees three wayfarers, three travelers who are coming through right in front of his tent. He says to God, in essence, Abraham has a conundrum. He has God who is visiting him. Imagine if God appears to you, and then you have a mitzvah, a commandment to fulfill, and that is to take care of the wayfarer. He could have ignored the wayfarer and just stayed there because he had this moment of encountering the God's presence. But instead he said, don't leave my God, just stay there for a moment. I've got to carry out this act of taking care of these people. Please don't leave. Don't go. And Abraham runs. So typically that's how it's understood to me. And that is that God appears to Abraham. He's visiting Abraham. What's the context? Well, God has already been appearing to Abraham from the last chapter. Why would God need to be with Abraham? He's recovering from circumcision. And he's a man who's nearly 100 years old. So Abraham runs to greet the wayfarers. Abraham's modus operandi was very simple. He would feed people who came by his home. They would, at the end of their meal, thank Abraham and his wife for the food. Abraham would then say, don't thank me, thank God. And they go, what? And that's how he would convey the message that God is the creator of everyone, and he was able to transform so many souls. That's why the scriptural commandment to thank God for food is not before you eat, but after you eat, like Abraham. That's how Abraham was able to convey to people to thank God. It was after they finished a meal. V'chalta v'savata, you shouldn't be satisfied, uv'irachta Hashem Elokecha, and you should bless the Lord your God.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, tell me if I've got this right. And this is also, I think, Jason, I think you were referring to this. So he is spending time, the Lord appears to him, he is speaking to his God. As you said, he's just been circumcised, he's 100 years old. And during that time, he looks up and behold three men standing there, and he shows them hospitality, incredible hospitality. Mm-hmm. And during that encounter, we discover that these three men that he sees are indeed three messengers of God. One of them conveys to or reiterates the promise that Sarah will have a child. This is the first time Sarah's heard this, and she laughs. That messenger's job is done, is what you're saying. The other two have another job to do, and that is to continue on to Sodom and rescue Lot. Now, in that,
and destroy the city.
Roles, right. From verse 17, where it says, "And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing?" Are you saying from verse 17 to the end of the chapter of chapter 18, this here is a conversation that Abraham continues with God, not with one of the messengers?
Right. That means his conversation with the messengers is done. Two of them leave. The other one has already done his job. And now he's having a conversation with God. God is saying...
He's back where he began, perhaps right. Sitting in the door of his tent, resuming the conversation he was having with his God.
Right.
So in the translation I've got in front of me, it says, "And Sarah laughed within herself," which I read kind of in her own mind, saying, yeah. After I am waxed old, shall I have the pleasure, my Lord being old also. And then the Lord said to Abraham. So I'm assuming that when Abraham is spending time with God at the beginning of this verse, God's not physically in front of him. It's kind of more of a spiritual interaction. And so why, that seems natural to me then, that conversation could carry on in the presence of other people.
Now if I understand what you're saying, Jason, because I'm looking at it in my Christian translation, the New King James Study Bible, it says, "Is anything too hard for Jehovah?" Mm. And it says, at the appointed time, I shall return to you according to that time. And he said, it goes on in 15, but Sarah denied it, saying, "I didn't laugh," for she was afraid. Mm. And he said, "No, you did laugh." Now, when it says he, I've got a capitalized he, Tobia. Capitalized he referring to God. Is that potentially referring to Abraham saying, "No, you did laugh"? Is this an in other words, no, is this an audible conversation?
It's in the feminine.
It's in the feminine.
Yeah, vayomer loy ki tzochok, and that ends with a tough with the two dots, and that's in the feminine. That you have left female. It's in speaking of a
you,
woman.
But right. he said, now I've got the he capitalized, referring to God. So
God's name is not in there.
Okay, so this is not good. Now, are you telling me that this is not God speaking back to Sarah saying, "No, you did laugh"?
Well, this is God conveying to her that, in fact, you did laugh.
Is an audible conversation.
Right. That means that.
Do you see where we're going with this?
Okay. Yeah, that this information is being conveyed by God. The text is silent on whether God is using Abraham, who was a prophet, to convey that to his wife, whether God is saying that directly to Sarah. It's very unlikely that the conversation that the conversation was audible to everybody. And I'll tell you, people say, "Well, how could you possibly know that?" Well, this is one of those instances where, and I'm going to say something and people are going to be shocked by this, where God lies, kind of. And you go, "Well, God cannot lie." Well,
God is not a man that he...
He won't lie. But this is what God wants to keep. This is how important it is to keep peace in the family. And there is a tradition that in order to keep peace between a husband and wife, that one may sort of leave out information, and you don't have to say everything if it's going to jeopardize somebody's marriage.
That's not a lie. That's selected information, right?
And God does that, and he actually selects information. If you notice that when Sarah said that, how can I have children? She says this to herself, at Titzchak. Titzchak means she laughs at it. It means that she said two things. She said, it's inconceivable that I can have children. Why? Well, she says, because I'm too old to have children. And frankly, my husband is too old to get me pregnant. Okay. You notice that. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you notice that when God then goes to Abraham, he leaves out the part where his wife said, and my husband is too old. If you look carefully, the text says that God said to Abraham that Sarah said that she that is too old. But he deletes what Sarah said about her husband is not to create family strife, because naturally it would embarrass Abraham. It would make Abraham uncomfortable. It would cause a family strife. It would undermine what's called shalom bayis, peace in the home, if God would tell over verbatim precisely what Sarah had expressed. So God leaves that little piece out. Mm-hmm. So that's not conveyed. So we see there that we don't have a loudspeaker situation going on. We don't have God is speaking and everyone can hear everybody, because then there would be no sense in God deleting it. That doesn't make sense. In fact, he has to repeat it and essentially strip out one modifier, which would have been unnecessary. Abraham didn't have to hear that his wife said that he's too old to make her pregnant. He didn't need to hear that. So we don't have a loudspeaker system here, and that tells us that quite clearly.
So just to be clear, then the conversation that is conveyed from the messenger, that she shall have a child, is not the same audible voice that she is hearing when God is rebuking her for laughing. It's not coming from that messenger, is what you're saying.
Right.
They're two distinct. Okay, so it can be that way. But we know, though, there are examples where messengers speak in the first person of God, right? I mean, for example, Moses before the burning bush, right?
Oh yeah, there's numerous examples where, in fact, the biggest example is here. This is what's interesting. What is fascinating about this passage? I mean, I can go off with you and tell you about where angels are called God, and some, we have Psalm 8 and we have and so on. But there is no better example of it than where we are right now. So as it turns out, and it's counterintuitive, but the very passages which the church has appealed to point to the fact that God came as a man, in fact, is what demonstrates that angels are in fact called God in the most direct way. This is no longer a linguistic issue, as we're going to see in chapter 19, when the two angels, and here, as I said in Genesis 8, 19, verse 1, when they go down to rescue Lot, and of course, what happens in the very beginning of the chapter is that the people of Sodom, who are so wicked and so evil, when they get wind of the fact that Lot has invited two men to his home, they want to sexually molest them. I mean, we can now, everything is coming into view. We can see the absolute astonishing depravity of this city, and they're going to be judged. They want to sleep with these two men. Lot's going to do something really quite stupid, and that is offer his daughters in their stead. That, of course, the two angels get Lot out of trouble by blinding the people around the house, who are literally coming to rape these two men.
What is? You can't breeze over that. I've got to stop you there. You can't just go, Lot was going to do something silly, but let's keep going. What was going through his mind that he thought, let's do this instead? Do you have any idea? I mean, can it be explained?
What we could see is the outcome of it. That's all the toitso, which means the result is going to be something horrible is going to happen with his daughters in a sexual nature. And that is, at the end of this chapter, we see mida keneged mida. If somebody sins, if someone acts in a way that is wicked or depraved or iniquitous, then that person is not punished in any arbitrary way, but that person is dealt with quite directly in the manner which he did. The reason is that God is not trying to be cute or anything. It then becomes easy if someone is punished in the manner that they are sinned, so then they can figure out, oh, I'm being punished for this because look how I... So Lot is going to be dealt with for this absolute outrage. Lot's own daughters are going to, after the Sodom is destroyed, they are hiding in this little place they stopped.
So
in the cave, and so are Lot's daughters are going to look out of the cave, and I think it's easy to make a picture, and you're going to see a world that's destroyed. And that place, you've been to Israel and Jason's going to Israel, stinks of sulfur. I don't know if stink is the right word, but there's the smell.
I'm holding a piece of sulfur from there in my hand as we speak.
This is not, just for those who've not been, if you've been to Israel, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you've not been to Israel and you're driving down that highway, you know, going from Jerusalem, whatever, to the Dead Sea, and you're going down, 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 you can feel the pressure changes in your ear, you're going to the lowest place on earth, there is a, I don't want to use the word stench, because we're talking about Israel, there is such a strong odor of sulfur, it's overwhelming. It's not like, no one has to tap you on the shoulder, it just, right there. And people travel from around the world to bathe in the Dead Sea, which is full. It is the saltiest water in the body of water in the world. And the place reeks of sulfur. And the whole place does. This is not, you know, this is, you know, quite, you know, it's in a sense still smoking. So what Lot does is absolutely unimaginable, offers his daughters. Here we see that Lot is a little bit different than the neighbor, quite different than Abraham. Lot is being saved. He's not as bad as the people of Sodom, but he is not anything remotely like Abraham, and he's clearly being saved, and his family is being saved, not because they directly merit it as much as they're part of the family of Abraham, and they are certainly steps ahead of the people where they live, their own neighborhood, the people of Sodom. And that's why
it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because in verse 23 of chapter 18, Abraham asked that so very famous question, would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? And there's this bargaining, if you like, going on, this negotiating going on from then on. And then we find out the only ones that seem to be saved from Sodom and Gomorrah is Lot, and we see this kind of behavior, and we think, how did he manage to squeeze into that category of the righteous, and yet he does.
Well, here's something delicious, and it's so tender, and that's why I encourage you, the listener, every passage like Ezekiel, like put it in your mouth, and it'll taste like honey to you. There's something very, very exquisite going on here, and you can see I'm trying to conjole every listener to see how beautiful the language is. You'll notice that Lot and his family somehow merit to be saved from Sodom. Barely. They're the family, they're not as bad as Sodom, but they're not in the right place. You notice that as they're leaving, because they're not really worthy on their own merit, they're not allowed to look at the destruction of Sodom. They're forbidden to do this. Right, and in fact, Lot's wife stupidly turns around in the midst of this, and she turns into a pillar of salt, which happens right there. So they are not allowed to gaze upon this destruction because, all right, we're going to save you, but you don't have enough zechus and merits to be able to look at it. So just keep walking and do not look. But you'll see that later on, Abraham, that means after this occurred, Abraham is going to stand on top and is going to look at the destruction of Sodom. He's going to gaze on it. He is allowed to look at it. Lot and his family are not allowed to look at it. So we can see the distinction. See, it all flows. If you really read these passages, you'll see how every passage introduces why it's important that Abraham is gazing. He sees the aftermath of this absolute nuclear bomb that goes off, leaving nothing but ash, sulfur, and that's what we smell to this day in that place. And there's actually a place, it's a tradition, but where we have Lot's wife, a big thing of salt. But the point is that Abraham is able to gaze upon this devastation. We could see how evil they are. Lot is not on the right track, but he's part of the right family. When the angels come to now, so God is saying that I am going to destroy the city. But we look at chapter 19 of Genesis. I want to break apart the events that occur here. The angels now are in Lot's home. The people of Sodom are temporarily blinded, and ultimately, of course, the people who want to rape Lot are, you know, and the contrast is extraordinary. Of course, we can see how great Abraham is. Look at these people, the opposite. Abraham is trying to take care of strangers. See, don't forget that. That's what's happening. We have a juxtaposition. We have Abraham. He sees three travelers, and what does he want to do? He wants to feed them, to wash their feet and so on, give them the best food possible. Mm. When the people of Sodom find out that strangers, wayfarers, have come into the city, what do they want to do? They want to rape them. Okay, so never let go that clench on these passages. The juxtaposition here is so startling, it's supposed to hit you over the head. And these, what's called zvugim, these comparisons go on throughout Tanakh. We just happen to be looking at these passages, but everything is in here. Every verse, every letter is here for a reason. I showed you earlier, even the word laughter, there's one letter difference, and that's, you know, that could tell you if you're laughing with joy or laughing at something. Lotus is asked, are there other people in the home that need to come along? And Lotus, of course, has a wife. But in addition to that, he has two daughters and he has two sons-in-law. Now, you'll notice that what happens is, and if you go to Genesis chapter 19, here we see it very clearly. In chapter 19, verse 13... Lot now, these two sons-in-law are being informed that...
They're not taking him seriously. It says, no. So Lot went and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters and said, get up, get out of this place, for Jehovah will destroy this city. But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking.
Right. But if, now, if we look at the text, it does not read this way. I mean, if you look at the text, you'll see here that it says there that, in fact, we are going to destroy the city. Look at verse 14. And I don't know which version of the version you're looking at. But
the,
what
the
it
New
says
King
here,
James, yeah.
Okay, so what we have over there is in verse 14. I don't know how the New King James reads, but we have there that we're going to destroy this place because the cry has been so great in front of Hashem, been so terrific, in verse 14. And Lot conveys this to his entire family, his sons-in-law, which married his daughters. And why? Because God is going to destroy the city. Mm-hmm. So what's happened here is we have the angels are going to destroy the city, and we have here God is going to destroy the city. And if you're still not sure about this complete flow, this interchange between the two, we could just go a little bit further on in Genesis 19. What's happening now is Lot is fleeing the city with his family, and Lot is not a young man. And Lot says to them, If I can find any favor in your eyes, if you please let me just rest somewhere. Can I stay here at this place, Tzohar, essentially, and just rest here? If that would be so, you know, if you will not overthrow the city, okay? And he said to him, see, I've accepted what you're saying concerning this, and I will not overthrow the city which you spoke. So here we have the back interchange in the fact the Lot is pleading with the angels who are taking them physically, the family, by the hand. They have to run with them. And, of course, they can came up. And then it says in verse, going a little further in verse 24, a repeated text. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven.
Out of heaven, yeah.
Out of heaven.
So he overthrew those cities, all the plain, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. Jason, have you got any thoughts going on there?
I've got one question for Tovia. The daughters of Lot, virgins or not virgins?
That's a good question, because Lot identifies them as virgins, but the question is how would they have sons-in-law, I presume is the question.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
Oh, that's a really good question. I'd never ever thought of that. That's a really good question.
Right. So in again, this is where we're going in from the ancient world into the modern world, and that is in the ancient world, people didn't get married all at once, but at first people were betrothed, and that's not engaged, but there was a kind of betrothal there where it was people are promised them, and they're considered already husband and wife. In fact, if they wanted to break up, they had to give a bill of divorcement. And this, in fact, is going to be used by the book of Matthew to explain how Joseph can be betrothed to Mary, yet she being a virgin. Interesting that Lahavdil, but that will come up later on. So therefore, in the ancient world, things were a little bit different. If people were betrothed to each other. It's more than engagement, but they hadn't yet necessarily slept with each other.
Man, does that mean that in the cave, then that was
the first time? Yeah,
it only gets worse. Anyway, yeah. Tovia.
Yeah. So what's very important, I hope what people are walking away from here is not just how a passage is, if they're not read in context, and how passage after passage is not being apprehended. And what typically happens is that for most Christians, these passages are, you know, one verse here or another verse there, but not all of it carefully studied. You know, what happens is that people, this information can be lost. But this is understandable, how people can make the mistake. If you're looking at Genesis 18, so you're right. You don't have Genesis 19, verse 1 in front of you, who were told in no uncertain terms that these are angels. How many vayavo'u shnei hamalachim sodomu? And the two angels came to Sodom. Very few Christians will read that passage. Instead, they're seeing what you described, Jason, earlier, is an apprehension of the triune Godhead. Here we see in Genesis 19, verse 1, in fact, they're angels. We see interchanged, just as Moses wasn't literally God coming to Pharaoh, but represented God. He is called God for that reason. Those who are teaching the law, who are judges, are called God. This is also, by the way, that's going to be used in the Christian Bible in the opposite direction. It's something that I find most scholars don't get, and I know I'm going off target with your permission, but in John 30, I even see scholars making this. The book of John is very strange because John has, as I mentioned earlier, this prologue which has this very exalted view of Jesus, the most exalted view. But whoever wrote this book also wants to convey is that this is not God, the God created the universe. And therefore you have some of the most subordinative language in the book of John as well, meaning language and passages in the book of John conveying or seeking to express this point that Jesus is in fact not the God. Now, I know many listeners are going, what are you talking about, Singer? Well, in the ancient world, there was the God. In the Greek world, that would have been Zeus. He's the ultimate God. In the Roman world, that would have been Jupiter. But then there were whole levels and series of God, different stratas of God. And this I explained in my book, that there are different stratas of God. And no one in the ancient world ever thought that the lower gods were ever in anything like the ultimate high God. The only thing is that Jupiter was so huge, he was so enormous, that you couldn't pray to him, and people didn't pray to Jupiter, because Jupiter, frankly, he was too busy running the universe to be bothered with that your cow would give birth, or you'd have milk, or you'd have wine. Don't bother Jupiter or Zeus with that. So in the ancient world, they didn't pray to Jupiter and Zeus. There were state ceremonies celebrating and with offering sacrifice, but people didn't, because he's up there, he's way, so there's different stratas. My point here is that you will have in John, only John, a very clear statement much later on that would, after the in the resurrection narrative, what's called the passion narrative, you have Jesus saying, I'm going to God, for the Father is greater than I am. You'll only have those exact words in the book of John, one of the most important creeds of Christianity, John 17:3. This is eternal life, that they may know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom thou hast sent. And the Greek word for only there is manos. We all know what that word means. Mm-hmm. It means only, to exclude all others. So John is also the author of John. Again, this is another completely anonymous book, the fourth gospel. But whoever wrote it is going out of his way to say, look, Jesus is from some past, prior to a baptism. In fact, the baptism of Jesus, the only book where the baptism is never mentioned is the book of John. Because John doesn't baptize, he's not important to him. And being born is not important, because Jesus comes from something earlier than his conception, from some place way back. This is going to be something that Christians are going to be arguing about. But what John also wants to convey is Jesus, because John is being written some 15 years after the book of Matthew and Luke. They're probably around the year 90, 95, very late in the first century. At this point, Jesus is a God. He's like in that Hercules, Pythagoras, Romulus level. Mm-hmm. He's not the Jupiter, but he's somewhere in between. And this distinction is going to be made. Now, in John chapter 10, I'm going to find there's a passage which we're all familiar with. And that is that Jesus says, I and the Father are one. Very, very famous. Very famous chapter. And we're told in the book of John that Jews picked up stones that they wanted to kill him, you know. Mm-hmm. They wanted to kill him. So, and I've heard this. We've all heard this so many times. Here, Jesus is clearly proclaiming that he is God, right? And because he's saying, I and the Father are one. And Jesus asked them, why do you want to kill me? Why are you doing this? You know, is it because of the great works that you do? And they replied, not because of the great works that you do, but that you are making yourself equal with God. I'm not taking anything out of context. Just follow this along. It's a story in John chapter. If you're a Hasidic Jew and you don't have a Christian Bible, don't go out and buy one because this show. Don't bring it home because blame it on me.
It's in John chapter 10.
Yeah. If you're in Holiday Inn, so you'll see there. If you're in the Holiday Inn, you can do it, but please don't bring home a Christian Bible.
The Gideon's in the top drawer. So they picked up the stones again to stone him, and Jesus answered, many good works have I shown you from my Father. For which of those do you stone me? And the Jews answered him, saying, for good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy, and because you, being a man, make yourself God. And Jesus answered, is it not written in your law? I said, you are gods. If he called them gods to whom the word of God came, and the scriptures cannot be broken, right. Do you say of him whom the Father sanctified and sent into the world, you are blaspheming, because I said I am the Son of God.
Right. Now, this is very critical. He says, doesn't it say in your scriptures that you are God? I mean, what does this come from? Is it not written in your law that I've said you are gods? Verse 34. Right, in the book of Psalms. Now, what passage is it talking about? What are we told? What is in the book of Psalms? Now, very few people look this up. So if you go to the book of Psalms...
Psalm chapter 82,
right.
God stands in the congregation of the mighty. He judges among the gods.
Right.
He says in verse 6, I said, you are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High.
I have a feeling that for most of the people listening to this show, this is the first time you've ever heard this. And I've always been challenged of why people will go, whoa, it says in your scripture. Well, this, interestingly, is the one passage from the Jewish Bible that is, in fact, used properly, meaning it's not taken out of context. The response nobody gets, even Christian scholars who are saying, well, baby John is saying that Jesus is God, they miss the point that the response that John is placing, I instantly... Of course, do not believe this conversation ever occurred, but let's for a moment suspend that. The response is that I have said you are gods. Well, what does that mean? We go to Psalm 82, and just so you know, Psalm 82 is telling us that judges, just like in Deuteronomy 17, because what are judges doing? They are teaching, they are expressing God's word. They're teaching, they're conveying, they're encapsulating God's word as a judge, and therefore they are called God, and they are called God in the Torah. So therefore, John's Jesus is coming to modify what he means, I and the Father are one. It does not mean that we are of the same substance, but just as judges are called God, why are they called God? Because they're on the same side as God. They are conveying over God's message. I am no more God than those judges are, and therefore there's no reason to stone me. This is very critical. And the Greek word there for one is a simple word which means hen, which means God. And strangely, we have one of the longest prayers of Jesus. Now, who is Jesus talking to in this very elaborate prayers to God? Of course, if you one believes in Trinity, none of that makes sense. But Jesus is having this long conversation with God, and he makes a prayer in John 17, verse 11, saying that when he gets crucified, he wants to make sure that the disciples are unified and that they don't fall apart. And he says to the Father whom he's pleading with, he says, let them be one as we are one. Same Greek word used there is hen, meaning John has Jesus saying that disciples should be one in precisely the same manner as the Father and Jesus are one. Not that they're of the same substance. This is going to be later than John, the notion that Jesus was fully God. There is good reason why Christians fought against this idea, who were called Arians and so on, who said, no, Jesus is completely subordinate to the Father. And when he calls himself one with God, he's saying he's one with God, just as disciples should be one. One means not of substance, but in purpose.
So these kind of problematic texts within the New Testament, finally, the culmination happens at the Council of Nicaea, right? I mean, is that that's where it happened? Where most Christians think that the phrase "fully man and fully God" is in the New Testament, but that actually came from Constantine. Have I got that right?
That's going to come later. Constantine in 325. In 325, all the interlocutors, and there are a few hundred of them, Constantine is going to invite nearly 2,000 bishops, so probably 300 will show up. But there's a war going on, and the war is going on between the two groups. So they're both sides. This is important. All the interlocutors in Nicaea in the summer of 325 believe Jesus was divine. The argument is, how divine was he? This is important. Now, this goes back to an earlier part of our show, and that is we are using a very different language today among ourselves, whether I speak to a Christian. We today, in our day, in the 21st century, we use the word God, we mean the creator of the universe, and no one else gets that name in our current vernacular. Whenever I teach my students, whenever I teach history, I teach the ancient world classes on this, and I've devoted a chapter to this. What I do is, it's very important for the students to understand that they have to detach themselves from our current worldview and understand that in the Greco-Roman world, there was a whole hierarchy of gods. So if you said to someone in the ancient world that Romulus or Caesar was God like Zeus, therefore they would laugh at you. You would be laughed out of court. But they still could be called gods, born of virgins, and so on. In the same way, John is going to work very hard in his own book to say, yes, Jesus represents God. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. But he is not the absolute God. And that's why reasonable Christians, when I say reasonable, means Christians are going to fight over this. This is going to be a very big deal. One of the points should be made. The church fathers, all of them, were very anti-Semitic. I mean, they really couldn't stand Jews. And they said some awful things about Jews, and they wrote books against Jews. And in fact, they actually wrote books. People like Tertullian literally wrote a book called Against the Jews. I mean, that was the name of the book. So Jews are insulted by this. But one of the points I seek to bring out is that, in fact, they wrote, even though they didn't like the Jews, they wrote things about other Christians that were far more offensive. They really fought over what you believe, and if you didn't believe exactly their orthodoxy, they said that you were followed the devil. They said really the most unkind things about each other. We see that
sounds
today.
Like a lot of things that you're hearing about it today, right. In the Islamic State, right? We're hearing from ISIS.
Or language. The only difference is that the ISIS, the Sunni terrorists that are sweeping across the Middle East, they've got weapons at their disposal. In the ancient world, certainly prior to Nicaea, Christians were a minority, sometimes oppressed, and as a result of that, this was very rhetorical. Christians couldn't do anything; they couldn't hit someone. They will later on, after Nicaea, they will go to war with each other, kill each other in wars that will last 100 years. But none of that can go on. Before Nicaea, Jews were safe. Judaism was a recognized religion in the Roman Empire, comprising probably 10% of the Roman Empire. At the beginning of the 4th century, only about 5% of the Roman Empire is Christian. By the end of the 4th century, of course, all that changes, and the estimates are from 50 to 70% of the Roman Empire is now Christian. It is the religion of the empire. Everybody at Nicaea believes that Jesus is a god. This doesn't make sense to the American ear, to the Irish ear, to the Australian ear, to the Western ear. What do you mean, a god? Well, in the ancient world, that made complete sense. There was the absolute creator, Jupiter, Zeus, but there's a whole tier in between. And John was going to work very hard to say that this is not the absolute, Jesus is not the absolute God, but he's somewhere in between. And John is there's a rationality. John is speaking in the Greco-Roman world, where what he is saying makes sense. To our world, this doesn't make sense. And that's why it's important to apprehend what John's conveyed. This is not going to be good enough. So this is going to go further and further as I mentioned earlier, beginning of this broadcast, some unknown scribe is going to insert into the Latin translation. He won't do it into the Greek translation. He's going to insert into 1 John 5, 7, and 8 an absolute Trinitarian text, which it is. And what's going to happen in the early 16th century is a humanist scholar from Rotterdam, really a brilliant man, Erasmus, is going to seek to publish the first New Testament. He leaves the Latin passage out of his first, he's the first person to publish a New Testament because the printing machine just started, and he leaves it out. He's accused of blasphemy, that maybe Erasmus doesn't believe in the Trinity. Erasmus says, look, I've looked at all my manuscripts, and frankly, I couldn't find one with what's now called the Johannine clause, and which is a clause.
The Johannine comma.
Comma, excuse me, that which is this clause. It's this extra piece there. So he says, so they actually make one for him. Actually, a Franciscan writes a New Testament, a manuscript for him, back translates the Latin, as the story goes, into Greek, and now Erasmus can go ahead with publishing a Christian Bible, which will be the principal text that those who assemble the King James are going to rely on. And of course, that's the story behind how this little clause from the Epistle 1 John, and just so people know, 1 John is also an anonymous book. We don't know who wrote it. But that's how it makes its way in.
But that's inserted into the text, and, yes, and we know that for a fact. But what it doesn't do is nowhere to assert the Trinitarian theology, does it go back to Genesis chapter 18 right, and try and make a case. And even, as you pointed out, Christian apologists know that and would certainly not go there. Nevertheless, as Jason said, and as I've experienced as well, the layman, if you like, the average Christian, will certainly go there to try and support such a theory, but really it's absolutely without foundation. Jason, any parting thoughts, my friend?
I'm just considering the huge amount we've covered in the last 2 hours.
We've just covered so much, I can't believe how much we have covered, and yet, even though Tovio's just opened his brain and just let it all fall out and we've got everything there to consider, it is nothing compared to what is in the two books, Let's Get Biblical, Why Doesn't Judaism Accept the Christian Messiah, Volume 1 and 2, dear listeners, mandatory reading for everybody. You can find it at outreachjudaism.org. Outreachjudaism.org is the website, and they're hot off the press. So is there plenty of copies to go around? I mean, are we running out yet, or what's going on?
No, apparently they can keep printing it. So certainly
it's all right. That's okay. We've got plenty there, but don't dawdle, because you want to get into it. It's a good read, and so much more detail there for you. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on to Truth to You to just iron out that Trinitarian theology and what's actually going on in Genesis chapter 18 and 19, my friend. Always appreciate your time. Do you have to battle the Jakarta traffic once again?
No, I'm done for the day.
You're going to stick around there for a little bit longer.
Oh, yeah.
Until next time. Thank you, Jason. SpiritualBabies.net and OutreachJudaism.org. Tobias Singer. Until next time, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.